Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Quick note before I get into the episode. Today kicks off this month's daily episode series. I really enjoyed recording daily episodes at the start of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Doing so helped me think through the biggest moment of the year. So with this series, I hope to do the same on a bigger scope, looking back on 2022. There are always going to be too many episodes this month for any one person to listen to, so here's how I best recommend you go through this series. Treat it almost like a buffet. Pick and choose the episodes and topics that are most of interest to you. Three quick requests. Number one, this was the year we started monetizing the podcast with Supercast, putting a lot of work into these daily episodes over the next few weeks. So if this or any other episode I do particularly resonates with you, I'd really appreciate it if you went to realignment.supercast.com or click the link in the show notes to support the show, helping us wrap a great 2022. To keep up with everything I'm putting out, this is the second request, definitely check out the Substack, which goes out every Friday, including today. My goal is to start adding transcripts of episodes. That's been something people have really asked for lately, so those will be linked there as well. You can find the link to the Substack in the show notes. Last but not least, if you enjoy this or any episode, share it with a friend and leave us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. And now on to the episode. Today I'm speaking with Noah Smith, econ blogger and writer of the No Opinion Substack. We cover a lot in this episode, but the primary theme is that 2022 marked the actual end of the 2010s decade, much in the same way that the quote-unquote 60s didn't actually begin on January 1st, 1960, and didn't even end until the 1973-1974 period that marked the end of the Vietnam War and Richard Nixon's. In his telling, the 2010s were all about upheaval, populist revolt, reacting to the world that came out of the 2008 financial crisis, and then obviously Brexit and Trump's election in 2016. Instead, the 2020s will be defined by exhaustion and the feeling that almost nothing is actually happening. We talk through what this means, how the rest of the 2020s will be more like the 1970s, why that actually bodes really well for the 2030s and 2040s. Let me know how you are enjoying the series, if there's any other topics I should cover. Huge thank you, of course, to Lincoln Network for supporting the podcast work and helping us bring you all this great content. Noah Smith, welcome to The Realignment.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, really glad to chat with you. This is the first of my end of the year wrap-up episodes, kind of going over themes that have been of interest to folks. And I think that you are not only one of my favorite Substackers, but I think you do a great job of hitting just the broad general topics. So I'd love to do an episode kind of just reflecting back on your work then. Let's start here. Reading you, I get the sense that we're going to kind of think of the 2010s as this long decade that may have just ended. Like the 2010s is going from, you know, 2010 post-financial crisis to the tech crash, Republicans kind of flaming out in the midterms. So I'd love to hear what you would articulate the 2010s as, like this moment of unrest you kind of refer to it as. How should we understand them?
Right. Well, so I think, you know, eras in America don't really line up with decades exactly. We just like to say that. And so I think we've had three eras this century so far, and we're starting on the fourth right now. And the first era was the George W. Bush era with the war on terror and the Iraq war and the build out of the early internet and like LiveJournal. It's the LiveJournal era, right? And that all ended, and where everyone made a bunch of money on real estate. That all ended in the Great Recession, financial crisis, Lehman, all that stuff, and the election of Obama, you know, created this other era. And so I'd say that there was this interim era of the first Obama term. It was this very short era where we were just dealing with the Great Recession. We killed Osama bin Laden, so that was done. We you know, pretty much pulled out of Iraq. And so there was this like little calm period, you know, in the late 2010s and late 2000s, early 2010s, you know, where we were just sort of catching our breath and dealing with this, with the Great Recession. And then by 2013, growth had been restored. We were climbing back out of the Great Recession. And in fact, it was going pretty fast. And, you know, the for once, the people at the bottom of the distribution were starting to benefit in 2013. And so suddenly growth was restored. And then we got the smartphone, we got social media in the early 2010s. And you had this event. You've heard of the Eternal September. Have you ever heard of that one?
No.
So back in the ancient days, and this is before my time, but then every September, AOL would give out a whole bunch of free internet subscriptions to random people. Mm. And then so all these random people would show up on like IRC or whatever, just talking about nobody knows what. And they called it the September event. And at some point it just never stopped because enough normal people got on the internet where just normal people took over the internet, as they will take over anything eventually. And so when the normal people took over all the social media, because they all got smartphones and we got Twitter and, you know, updated Facebook and whatever. And so when they took over, you got mass politics transposing itself onto social media. And that was a big factor behind unrest. You had the end of the Great Recession. So suddenly, you know, just like dealing with immediate economic pain wasn't as big of a problem, but people were still pissed. So like you no longer had the need of like, well, let's put aside our differences and just focus on getting out of this recession. But at the same point, people were still mad because they lost their nest eggs in the housing crash. And so you had a lot of, you know, long simmering things bubbling to the surface, especially because you couldn't have like, you know, CBS News sort of keep a lid on unrest by presenting their like nice, moderate, center lefty picture of the world. And so various extremists took over. You know, you had like literal Nazis on Twitter and fighting with, you know, like the crazy anarchists that I, you know, would like to go to punk shows with were suddenly like on Twitter yelling about how we need anarchy. And like, anyway, you just got, and there were all these issues that were sort of festering in America. You know, we'd become this much more diverse country, but yet we hadn't sort of recognized it in popular culture yet. And, you know, women had become half the workforce and were increasing their presence in management, but we're still getting constantly harassed at work. And so you had all these sort of longstanding issues that I think like anger over that really, really bubbled over in the 2010s, starting around 2014, I would say, was really when. And so we've got this, the long 2010s, we could expand to have everything from the Great Recession to like, you know, now basically. Whereas the short 2010s, I would say, were just 2014 through the beginning of 2021.
Well, something I want to just, this is a total side note, but I think you kind of explained something that I'd never really thought of before. Your explanation of the Eternal September and social media becomes normified in 2014. Does this just mean that's why social media will never be cool ever again? Because all of us are basically pining for this world of 2009 to 2011, 2012, where our parents weren't on Facebook, where it was just this like very specific post high school, post college space, much as a hobbyist in the 1980s would probably love an AOL chat room, but didn't find them quite as compelling in the same way in 1995. Is that kind of explaining people's dissatisfaction from a nostalgia perspective from social media?
Maybe so, but I think that there's an eternal process of weirdos trying to outrun normies. And so now the weirdos are on Discord. You know, Discords are where everything's happening now. Like you get in people's Discords, you can talk to people, people speak freely, people, you know, like just it's that's where ideas are being incubated. That's where true opinions are being expressed. Twitter is more and more a ghost town. Facebook, utter ghost town, right? It's like Facebook is what, like, you know, 20 years ago was like chain email forwards of, you know, like your conservative grandma, like forwarding you things about how like black helicopters or whatever, blah, blah, blah. That's what Facebook is now. It's utter dead zone. It's, you know, there's always new spaces. The normies are always, or the weirdos are always trying to outrun the normies. And so I think that, you know, get on Discord. That's where the weirdos are now. And then in a couple of years, it'll be somewhere else. I don't know. You know, obviously Signal groups are a thing. Subreddits are still pretty weird. Like Reddit has not, community moderation works on Reddit, so they haven't cracked down centrally as much on weirdos. They did some, like they banned like a few subreddits, right? But people would just reform somewhere else. So like, I don't know, there's, I think they banned the incels. They banned incels. But then like, But there's still a fair amount of weirdos on Reddit. I don't know about Mastodon. That's something. But yeah, Discord. I think what Twitter was the unique one, not Facebook. Like everyone talks about Facebook all the time, but it was Twitter where all the journalists were all the time, all the academics were all the time, and all the politicians were all the time. And they were stuck in a room with schizo teenagers who would say the wildest shit from behind anonymous accounts, and that would be someone that you had to take seriously, right? There was this guy who got quote unquote doxed there, and now doxing used to mean releasing people's address, and personal info onto the internet. Now it just means revealing the identity behind a pseudonymous account, right? So doxing has been defined a little down, but some kid got doxed the other day. His Twitter handle was like City of Freaks or something. And he was just like, you know, just some college kid. And he was like, was writing stuff like, you know, if I were president, I'd throw Taiwan to the wolves or some, you know, sort of just little jackass shit like that. And so, but the point is that he had, I don't know, a lot of followers. He just like posted so many takes from behind the pseudonymous account and no one knew, you know, on the internet, no one knows you're a dog. Right? On the internet, no one knew that this was just some smarmy ass college kid. I mean, we can tell that he was a college kid, but like, but you know, it gives this sort of leveling effect, this respectability on Twitter, because you don't know who anybody is. And so if you just have 100,000 followers, you're more respected than some expert university professor with 10,000 followers. If you're just some schmucky kid with 100,000 followers, right? You're ahead. And so that's who politicians listen to. And so politicians got it into their heads that all these radical things were normal, because kids like that and foreign agents and kids from other countries, you know, some random bored Serbian teenager. I always like to say that your average like American alt-right fascist is some like, you know, bored Serbian 14-year-old from behind an anonymous account. That's who we gave influence in our media sphere. Those became our emperors, the rando shit posters on Twitter specifically, not Facebook, not any chat app, not Reddit, but Twitter specifically, absolutely elevated the biggest dipshits on the planet. And it's still doing that. I don't know if Elon Musk's chaos will be enough to like destroy that, but Twitter is still elevating all the dipshits. And it's just, the main hope is for Twitter to become a ghost town and for, you know, journalists and politicians and academics to go onto platforms where they're put more in contact with reasonable people and not just some schmucky kid just saying, let's throw Taiwan to the wolves because he can't get a date in real life or whatever.
So here's what I'm wondering. Why are we kind of, and this is where I think this is why the Vibe Shift New York Magazine piece resonated so much. I can't quite articulate why it feels like this long 2010s period is over, but it really feels like it's over. I think your post midterms piece where you said, look, I'm just kind of like a basic center left normie who wants stability and predictability in politics. It feels so weird that that's where everything ended. After all the upheaval of Trump, after the liberal world order coming to an end, I've kind of ended up where you are, but it feels kind of frustrated that it seems like we've kind of just circled back to where things are, at least from a kind of what do we want as a society perspective. So here's what I'm curious to hear from you. What did we learn from this 2010s period of upheaval? Like, what are the actual long-term takeaways beyond Twitter being full of dipshits?
Yeah. All right. I think you're right. I think that it's funny that this idea about the vibe shift came from this random, I don't even remember if it was Vogue or something. Some writer was on a deadline and wrote this insanely vapid article about like fashion, about how there was a vibe shift in fashion. And people just took this concept of the vibe shift and absolutely ran with it everywhere. And it became the universal language for the 2010s are over.
Yeah.
It just, from this one rando article, everybody started talking about vibes because everyone could feel that the 2010s were ending. And so what the hell, where are we now?
What did we actually, because an upheaval should lead you to conclusions. We've had 8 years to think through it. Like what have you learned?
What have I learned? I have learned that America, that the daily life in America pisses people off more than I realized. People Americans are more pissed off by their daily interactions than I realize.
Really?
And you find that every time you see someone who just like, you know, makes some big dramatic statement about society, and it turns out they're just pissed about some person who just dumped them and they're like 24. Like, you see very vividly that people have all kinds of problems, and, you know, people have relationship problems. People are, you know, have shitty bosses. People are ignored at work. Their contributions are ignored and passed over in favor of, you know, like bloviating self-promoters or whatever. And all these things, and people get microaggressions, you know, just people are like insensitive and rude and, you know, blah, 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 whatever on the street, in the store, at work, you know, and all these little things have created a lot more stress in America than I realized. America needs to chill. We took on too much stress in our lives. We ignored, economists would say we ignored transaction costs. You know, we ignored the fact that like all the things we're expected to do to live this perfectly optimized 2010 life, right? To be these 2010 era super people who could just manage everything, you know, nobody could. Everybody was having to cut corners, and everybody was getting ground down by that stress of, you know, little things, social costs, you know, like women at work who would have their coworkers just talk to them annoyingly about sex because the guys actually want to hit on them, but, you know, don't think they should. So instead they just like inappropriately talk about sex too much. That was like just a little transaction cost of life, a little thing people had to put up with. And then like, you know, I know, you know, Susan Fowler, I know her, she wrote the big, Uber, like I quit Uber manifesto, because basically people didn't value her contributions at work. And then at the same time, where, you know, all her male coworkers were trying to talk to her about sex all the time and is irritated. And so like, I get that, you know, and you don't think about that all the time. You don't think about other people's everyday travails. Until on Twitter, they're getting a mob to yell in your face. And so now I think we're all a little bit more aware of the daily shit that our fellow Americans have to put up with. It's very easy to forget about that daily shit because we're focusing on our own daily shit. But now I think we've remembered. So it's in some ways, I think that's a good change. It's brought us closer together as a society, even if the way it brought us closer together is having everyone scream at everybody. But like, anyone who's had a family knows that sometimes people screaming at each other is how people become aware of each other's issues and concerns. And so maybe ultimately it will make us more like a family in this country and less just like a, you know, atomized bunch of just people trying to like optimize our own little corner of the country, of the world.
You know,
I don't know.
When I'm thinking of this 2010s period, second half, it's really just defined by a response to the personal and like systemic shock that is Donald Trump's victory in 2016. So I'd like to go over a couple of those responses to that 2016 win. You've written about these. Let's start with a topic near and dear to the podcast's heart, like the new right. You know, the new right is a response to Trump in 2015, 2016, like this effort to, in good faith and bad faith ways, to focus more on the good faith, at least for a second, to turn that into like a practical political project that moves right forward. Let's just start with like your broad thoughts. You wrote a post on this. We'll link all these in the show notes. But, you know, what were your thoughts about the new right as a response?
Yeah, that was the most, that post, and possibly because that post lost me 70 subscribers from my blog. That's the most disastrous post I ever wrote.
That's a more than decent amount.
That's more than a decent amount. That's right. So that was, I took a pay cut from that post. Whatever. So then, but you know, I was right. So, you know.
Yeah, what did you argue?
I don't say things for money. I say things for, what I argued is that the so-called national conservatives, you know, the Blake Masters and Dr. Oz and Josh Hawley types, have no economic program. Like it's all cultural backlash. It's all just like, and then the cultural backlash that they're doing makes it impossible to have an economic program either. It's like, if you hate immigrants, and, you know, and you like hate education, like, and you hate all this, and you hate cities. What's left in our economy? Like, that's what our economy is based on. Immigrants, education, cities. Like, those are the engines that power our economy. You just, like, you kick away those supports, and, like, where's the, you know, like, your beloved, like, you know, blue-collar factory worker in Ohio, obviously white guy in, like, a small-town Ohio, that, like, you think about as, like, this quintessential American if you're on this new right. Where's that guy's money going to come from if, like, our high-tech industries collapse and our, like, big cities don't have people and our universities aren't pumping out, like, innovations and, you know, we don't have, like, you know, young workers to, like, pay into the social security system and all that, like, the whole structure we've built will just collapse from just these right-wing guys coming up and just kicking every part of it, you know?
Can I translate real quick? Because I 100% see why you lost. That post actually gained me as a subscriber, so like the math is kind of complicated here.
But I want to get the tide. I think he gained 30 and lost 70, so I think on net I lost 40.
Okay, I want to translate real quick because I think I want to have people understand like what you're saying here. So when you're talking about those three planks, hate immigrants, you mean not just reducing undocumented immigration, not just opposing a pathway to citizenship, but by saying explicitly lower legal immigration. From having it lower to actually be zero or even net negative. Secondly, your point about hating cities, just really like, and this is where it gets harder to be charitable, but just it's very directly like American politics is organized around like these coastal elites who have like structured their economy in a way that benefits them to everyone else. And then finally, with education, by hates education, you mean the broad critique of PMCs, the professional managerial class, who, like, once again, organized society. Like, these are the three segments of the yuppies, the Henrys, pick your poison. So knowing that those are the three areas, what do you mean by they don't have an economic program? Because I think even new right lists would say, no, I have an economic program. Like, I want a family to support. I want a single breadwinner to support a family like back during X period in American history. Why is that not an economic program? Like with it, it's an objective, but it's not like a program.
Right, exactly. That's exactly what I mean. So like I want a magic rainbow pony that can fly through space and like, you know, shoot like rainbows out its butt. But like, that's not happening. Like, you know, so Trump and Scott Walker thought they were gonna like, okay, so we want factories to come back to America. So we're gonna take, you know, we know all these factories have moved to China and Foxconn is the biggest company that moves factories to China. So we're going to take Foxconn. We're going to say, hey, Foxconn, build a giant factory in rural Wisconsin, which is a place that we like, full of the kind of people we like. And then we're going to get back those good blue collar jobs and the single breadwinner, you know, whatever, blah, 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 blah. And Foxconn's like, okay, sure. We'll take your incentive money that you're giving to us. And then, actually, guys, we can't really build this factory. Sorry, bye. Because Foxconn are a bunch of assholes. That's how they make their money. They're assholes. As you can see with the people now rebelling at the Foxconn plant, like nobody likes Foxconn. And so they're, you know, they'll just take whatever money they can get. Like, you know, there are really good Taiwanese companies that we want that are now building actual factories in America. Thanks, Biden, like TSMC, which is like Foxconn is all just based on like treating workers like shit. So why wouldn't they treat our governments like shit too? So then it was utter fantasy and the whole thing collapsed and it was just a giant boondoggle, most expensive, you know, corporate incentives we've ever dished out for absolutely nothing. That was supposed to be like this flagship thing that was going to lead to this renaissance. It was absolute castle in the sky bullshit vaporware. It was utter vaporware. Nothing like that ever happened because these guys don't understand the industrial structure of America at all. They don't understand America's place in global supply chains and what our comparative advantages, what we're good at, where we provide value, how we make money, and where we could make money, and where we are missing out on value. They didn't understand any of that. They were like, we like, you know, white guys in rural Wisconsin. That's who we like. We want them to have jobs. We remember the days of industry. And so we're going to magic that into happening. And there was nothing. So that's what I meant by no economic program. You can have goals, i.e. your goals can just be some imaginary utopia you just make up. But, you know, like, how are you going to get there? I mean, you know, that's like, even the communists had ideas for how to get to their goal. They didn't succeed, but they had, you know,
the 5-year plan had, there was the plan.
Right. There was like, right. Exactly. Like Trump didn't even have a 5-year plan. He had nothing except anger. It was a pure reactionary, just the word reactionary really applies very well to this whole thing, because he was just really just kicking against, you know, the way America was going. If you want to change the way America is, you've got to be smart about it. You've got to understand where it is now, how it got here, why it is that way, you know, and then you can maybe think about how it could change. But instead of just like, I'm going to kick it. That was their whole approach, is just kick it, kick it, kick it. And that's like, you know, just yell at it and just, you know, it didn't do anything.
Well, like China policy.
The biggest failure. So China policy is a little different. So Trump did kick at China in ways that it turns out that kicking at China is not helpful for America, but it is harmful to China. And so Trump's China policy in terms of tariffs was better than you think, because it cost Americans like a tiny amount of money. And all the libertarians were saying like, oh, look at all this money that it's costing us, you know, costing our consumers. And then you look at it, it's like a rounding error, right? It's like $1.12 a year or something. Like, no one gives a shit. And so am I allowed to say shit? Am I allowed to say bad words on this podcast?
We've crossed the line already, so we're all good.
All right. Oh, okay. So
it's fine.
We've dispensed with decorum, and we can say
the Friday episode, anything works.
Fair enough. All right. Gotcha. And but the tariffs did harm China, which we can see by looking at nightlights in industries like nighttime lighting, which is like, you know, factory workers working at night, warehouse workers working at night, office people. We can look at night lights in areas that had industries that were hit more and less by tariffs. We can see that China's economy was harmed a bit. So if you think this is war, China, you have decided to be our enemy. So you have decided to kick us. So guess what? You're getting kicked right now. Then in that sense, the kick it approach was somewhat effective. And Biden actually kept the China tariffs, because Biden is kicking China as well. And the sort of policy consensus of like pro-China, which held all the way up until Trump, has now given way to a bipartisan consensus that China needs a kicking. That's mostly driven by Xi Jinping taking power in China and turning it in a dramatically more anti-American and sort of aggressive direction. But we can get that later. The other policies that Trump did with regards to China, which were CFIUS, which was the investment restrictions on Chinese investment into the U.S. So China will try to buy this company that has strategic technology so they can extract the IP and then just sell off the company or whatever. CFIUS really reduced that a lot. So that was actually good. And the other thing was export controls, which a lot of people, including myself, worried about at the time, saying we can't sell high-tech equipment to Huawei, right? Huawei is this company that makes telecom stuff that could be used to like control global telecoms. And we're like, well, screw that. We're not letting that happen. So we're going to use our leverage over your high-tech suppliers from America and Europe to like stop you from getting the tech you need. And that basically kicked Huawei's ass. Like, Huawei
Why did
is
you
not...
worry? Why did you worry about that initially?
Oh, I worried because like it really does deprive U.S. companies of a lot of market. So I worried that, you know, like U.S. semiconductor equipment makers will suffer because they were selling a lot of equipment to China. And so under export controls, they will suffer. And I was worried that what would happen is that only the United States would do the export controls and that Japan and Europe would continue to sell their equipment to China. China's semiconductor industry would grow anyway, just with Japanese and European equipment instead of American. And that has changed now. So what happened now is the Ukraine war. Mm-hmm. And the Ukraine war crystallized global understanding that we weren't just looking at some like industrial reshoring, manufacturing, jostling, blah, blah, blah. That wasn't what's really going on. What's actually going on is a global struggle for power between two opposed blocks, Russia and China versus like, you know, America, East Asia, like rich East Asia and Europe, and hopefully India, you know, joining that. And that's really the breakdown. And the people in Japan and Europe who make the other makers of advanced equipment here understood that. And the Russia sanctions gave us sort of like the overarching authority to say, okay, look, guys, now we're going to do much more stringent export controls. We're going to just dunk on the entire Chinese semiconductor industry. So Biden has rolled out these really severe export controls. that go well beyond anything Trump ever did, to basically just strangle the Chinese semiconductor industry. And so far, it is looking effective. China will try very hard to find ways around it, but we will continue piling on more controls and solidifying that regime. And we may extend the export controls to other areas of high-tech manufacturing, such as high-tech engines, which are another thing where, like, we have a real technological edge, software, obviously AI stuff, maybe stuff having to do with electric cars, though I think there's nothing we can do. But economic warfare has replaced sort of, you know, reshoring as the reason for a lot of these things. Trump was talking about bringing manufacturing back. Now we're like, okay, well, maybe we'll bring manufacturing back, but what we're really going to do is punk China.
Mm-hmm. So let's hit another section of the ideological spectrum. Another response to 2016, going back to the original prompt, was democratic socialism. Bernie, DSA, a revitalized leftism that's very critical of the Obama era in a way that one wouldn't have expected, let's say, circa 2013. What were your thoughts about the left during this period?
I have a pretty negative view of this movement.
I'm noticing a theme here.
Right. So, like, you know, basically we had three unrest crystallized into three movements in America. And I would say that there was the, what we might call the woke, if you want to use that word, the woke progressive movement, which I think has its ups and downs. I think it did lots of important things. And then in some cases, like, went too far and made mistakes, et cetera. And you had the alt-right movement, the new right, which is now called the new right. All right. So it's like, I think alt-right reminds me of alt-rock from, like, the late 90s or whatever. It definitely wasn't alt. It was definitely the most radio-friendly, boring shit you ever heard. the new right, which I have a very negative view of, and then the socialist left, which I have also a very negative view of, though not as negative as the new right. The new right's the most, I don't see anything good about that. Like, that's just garbage fire.
Let me push you on this, though. I mean, it seems like the new right is at its best when it's critiquing the Republican status quo of 2015. Right? Like, the new right is at its best when it says, wait, it was absolutely insane that Jeb Bush was still defending the war in Iraq in 2015. I think the new right had very, I think, accurate and fair critiques to make of the Republican establishment.
So those critiques came on, like, so the Republican establishment conservatism had a disastrous decade in the 2010s. There were three pillars of the conservative movement that came out of the 70s, the 1970s. And those were, number one, economic laissez-faire, you know, get the government, drown the government in a bathtub, right? That idea, get the government off our backs, low taxes, deregulation, all that stuff. Pillar two, conservative Christianity. Pillar three, what we might call neoconservatism, or this muscular sort of, like, swaggering interventionism that started becoming popular and replacing the old isolationism that had been the hallmark of the Republican Party, you know, earlier years. So those all failed dramatically. There were three big failures. The first failure, the Great Recession, right? Not first in order, but, like, you know, yeah, first in the order I said them. The Great Recession was, like, showing that laissez-faire, you know, deregulating the finance industry just blew everything up, and tax cuts didn't do shit. And so that was sort of the economic failure. Culturally, conservative Christianity really hitched itself to, like, coming down on the gays.
Moral majority, like, you know, yeah, the movements.
Right. So much of it came down to anti-gay. Those conservative Christianity had gained a lot of sympathy. It, you know, anti-abortion sentiment actually rose as a result of that, and is one reason why the backlash toward Dobbs, although there is a backlash, isn't quite as big as it would have been in, you know, 1985 or something. And so, you know, divorce is down. Like, people, you know, the sort of, there was a big backlash against divorce, against casual sex. Like, now, you know, lefties are starting to have to think of their own reasons for people not to have a bunch of casual sex, right? And, you know, and it's not going well on that front. And so,
sorry, what are you, I'm not subject to that corner of Twitter. Like, what are you referring to?
Yeah. Oh no, they're just like, young people are just, you know, having a lot less sex, and they're coming out with a lot of, there's a lot of like really goofy politicized rhetoric about like why essentially every particular instance of people having sex is bad. You know, like actually hugging someone after sex is love bombing. You shouldn't do that. It's just creating all these terminologies that like you can then yell at people over. It's basically, it's Tumblr culture gone mad. It's very much the sort of leftist junior anti-sex league from 1984. It is really stupid. And it's basically come up with political reasons to hate every sort of intimacy or every sort of romantic relationship. It sucks. And so I'm glad I'm not, you know, a 24-year-old right now trying to date people. That would be very hard to navigate, right? Anyway, we could, that's a distraction, but conservative Christianity made a lot of, had the potential to make a lot of inroads, and it did make a lot of inroads. And then they just went crazy on the anti-gay thing. They were like, gay marriage is where we're going to draw this line in the sand. They could have been pro-gay marriage. They could have been pro-marriage, pro-traditional values, through saying like, well, gays, you better get married. Abandon your sinful lifestyle and get married. Right. And then instead, they were just like, okay, no, a marriage is between a man and a woman, blah, blah, blah. We're going to draw this line in the sand. And then, you know, the liberals were just able to say, love is love. Why are you restricting people's freedoms? And then that just, America's love of freedom and individual choice, you know, with combined with the fact that like gay people getting married, it obviously doesn't hurt anyone in the universe at all. Like it's the least harmful, least offensive thing you could ever imagine. Like, liberals just won that. So that was the second big failure of traditional conservatism. The third big failure, of course, is the Iraq War. And that was big. And the Iraq War, which, by the way, we won. We defeated all opponents and established Iraq as a proxy state under our de facto control, killing every single opponent. And yet it was still this giant debacle that everyone hated, proving that winning wars doesn't make wars worth fighting in the first place. That's the correct lesson from Iraq, but very few people seem to have learned this lesson. But Iraq was, everyone agreed that Iraq War sucked and we lied to get into it. And it was, you know, didn't get us anything. And it was just this debacle and made everyone hate us in the world, justifiably. And so, you know, made us the bad guys. And so the three pillars of the Reaganite conservatism all failed one after another in the 2000s decade. And so of course you had the new right arise partially as a response to that failure. What else can we do? So they decided to come in and do stuff that was even worse on all of these fronts. So on economics, they replaced this libertarian program with nothing, very loud nothing, you know, and just hapless flailing on economics. It is good that, you know, Republicans stopped trying to tax Social Security. Like Trump is like, okay, we're not going to do that. That was a tactical decision. And that was good that they stopped trying to attack Social Security. But then there was basically no economic program that they replaced it with. And then on sociocultural stuff, now you've got sort of this anti-trans backlash going on, or call it what you will. You can have names that are more favorable to the backlash than that. Backlash against radical gender ideology, whatever you want. So that's going on now, but then the sociocultural thing that they replaced the anti-gay thing with was anti-immigration. That was their new, they just took like, instead of cultural conservatism not focused on finding an out-group to hate, they decided that out-group is actually just immigrants. And so that was really bad. That was, you know, even worse because like, you know, the anti-gay thing was kind of doomed. The anti-immigrant thing, that unleashed classic, like, you know, racism 1.0 on America again, right? You didn't have subtle, you know, disguised second order dog whistling racism. You just had people like, this is a white Christian nation. And we, you know, like if any of your family, like you know, we're illegal immigrants. We're going to deport you even if you're a citizen, and, you know, all this stuff. Retroactive stripping of birthright citizenship was what Stephen Miller wanted to do. And so you just had this this hatred. And that, with that came all kinds of racism. You know, you had, like, if you just, you know, you had anti-Semitism came back. Like, that was part of the new right, is anti-Semitism. Jews suck. Look at, you know, look at now they've got Nick Fuentes and Kanye West just talking about how much Jews suck. And so you've had synagogue shootings, all that kind of stuff. That's real bad. That's like, I'm not going to downplay how bad the anti-gay stuff of like the 80s was, but I don't want to downplay that because that was bad. But like, the stuff they replaced that with after it failed was even worse and was not tied to any sort of like Christian cultural project. So the thing about conservative Christianity was there was something positive. There was a lot of negative stuff to it that ultimately was its downfall, but it also had a lot of positive stuff, like go to church, you know, the mega church movement, the evangelical revival, go to church, get married, all, you know, like traditional values and all this stuff. There was a way to live in that culture. You know, there was in 1992, you could go to church and you could, you know, like, you know, there was Christian singles chat. I remember Christian singles chat. I used to troll it as like a 13-year-old by pretending to be a caveman in Christian singles chat. That was my brilliant innovation, was caveman trolling. So I'd just be like, you know, like, we must hunt mammoth. where is meat cave? So like that was my absurdist trolling. I would go ahead and do that in Christian singles chat, and the poor Christian singles were like, what is going on in this chat room? Like, what?
Not a great introduction to the internet.
Yeah, why are there cavemen here? And so anyway, I was like, grr, og. But anyway, but there was a life you could live. Like, it felt like in the 80s and 90s, like the conservative Christian life was a life you could live. And there was even music about it. Even up to the early 2000s, there was music about living this conservative life. There was like this song about, like, I'm trying to remember. It was like about chicken fry and a cold beer on a Friday night. And like, there was, you know, it was this like rural conservative blue collar Christian ideal. And you could live, and that was attractive to people. Like the person who loves that song and still incessantly plays it.
You mean
like,
wagon? This is Wagon Wheel.
Is that what that song is called?
I think this is Wagon Wheel. Chicken
for the band. Cold beer on a Friday night. I don't,
yeah.
Like,
this is Wagon Wheel.
And so then
audience if I get that wrong.
Okay, but hold on. Now I'm gonna look it up. Hold on.
It's been a while since 2010's frat parties. So that's where.
Oh man, cold. No, it's Chicken Fried by the Zac Brown Band.
Okay, disaster.
It was released 2005. And that is the song, and that culture was already on the way out. But that was, you know, my friend who loves that. She's born in China. Her dad is like a famous China scholar from China, and absolutely, like, she came over when she was like, you know, 5 or 6 or something, and like, she loves that. That idea of this rural conservative life is so attractive to her. You know, she doesn't vote for the Republicans, but that's attractive to her. And that was, the new right has nothing that attractive. Like, how are you going to like go be like a snarky alt-right troll and go hang out with like Nick Fuentes? Like, that's your life? You're going to like go to like the alt-right meetups? No, there's no future in that. That's not a way to live. You can join the Proud Boys. There's nothing there. That's not a way to live. You're not gonna like your romantic life is gonna suck. Your social life is gonna meet all these chaos people. Like it's this, you know, you're gonna spend all your time as like a groiper posting frog memes on the internet, like, you know, in defense of Western civilization. That's like the lamest hobby you could possibly have. It's like, You would have so much of a better life being like an obsessive K-pop stan than living that alt-right life. There's nothing attractive. There's no culture there. There's no gathering place. There's no church to it, right? Like, the thing about conservative Christianity was you could go to church. That was the institution. Alt-right, the new right, has no church. No church except online shitposting, the church of shitposting. And that's an empty life that will leave people cold and empty. And so that in terms of foreign policy, so that's the second way in which the new right has replaced the failures of the old conservatism. They've replaced with just like jack shit. And then there's foreign policy, which the new right's foreign policy is just like suck up to Vladimir Putin. Like, you know, encouraging fascist empires to conquer the world is worse than the Iraq war. That's worse. Yes, it is bad. The Iraq war is really bad. A lot of innocent people died who didn't have to die. And it rightfully tarnished our image as a nation. But Vladimir Putin is worse than that.
Why?
Why is Vladimir Putin worse than that? Because Vladimir Putin is interested in conquest. He is interested in destroying the norm of fixed international borders that was created at the end of World War II and returning the world to a world in which large empires basically conquer up until they stop being able to conquer. They gobble up territory and people until they hit their limits and fight each other at the edges of their empires. It's the world of the European empires from pre-World War I that Vladimir Putin wants to bring back. And if you look at the rhetoric, it's all that. You know, they're talking about how all the pundits on Russian TV are talking about how after Ukraine, they'll take the Baltics and then Poland. It's basically, we'll conquer until we get stopped. And that sort of, and then this Chinese academic wrote this paper about the new world order when he's like, nations are like tigers eyeing their prey. We do not want a world of nations like tigers eyeing their prey. And in fact, the reason the Iraq war was so bad is because it was a big country, us, you know, acting like an empire and invading another country who hadn't threatened us and hadn't attacked us and blah, blah, just because we felt like it, because we're in a poopy mood from 9/11. And because George Bush wanted something to prop up his presidency because of other reasons. People wanted oil. I don't know. We broke that norm. We broke the fixed border norm that says, do not invade places. We'd broken it in small ways before. We invaded like Grenada or something. It's like under Reagan. The norm mostly held, right? Even in Vietnam, we were supporting one side in a Vietnamese civil war, basically. Right. That, you know, maybe we picked the wrong side to support. We did. And, you know, we did some brutal things in Vietnam in support of our chosen side. But at the end of the day, we were invited in by that government to support them in the civil war. And we had been an ally with them and blah, blah. We didn't break that norm. And, you know, the Soviet Union broke in Afghanistan and paid for it. And we broke it in Iraq. That was really bad. But we opened the door to Putin. But understanding why the Iraq war is bad, you have to understand why the thing we opened the gate so that the great evil from the ancient times could return to our world, blah, 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 right? It's like, and the great evil is just unrestrained imperialist conquest.
So it seems the critique of the new right at a foreign policy level is that, and this would be my editorializing, it'd be that the new right has a good post-op critique of decisions that the Bush administration made in 2003, it does not have a sufficient moral or good or well-framed response to Vladimir Putin. And something I want to get your thoughts on this, because I'm sure you've noticed.
Or Xi Jinping.
This is something I want to make clear for a second. I'm going to just make this prediction here. The funniest thing I see on Twitter is you see people on the new right say, it's a huge mistake for us to back Ukraine. We need to focus all of our attention on China, Taiwan. But if you actually look at the arguments that a lot of folks in the new right are using to attack backing Ukraine, they obviously apply just as much to Taiwan and to China. And the funny thing is, when you talk to a lot of people like on background, like they'll be, yeah, like we wouldn't actually support backing Taiwan in an actual conflict. So I get so frustrated when I see the whole like, Biden's not being realistic. We have to choose. We need to focus on Asia, when that entire political coalition on the right wouldn't stand 2 seconds, I think, given the current circumstances.
I agree. That's absolutely right. And so the reason those guys want to quote unquote focus on China, they don't want to actually do anything against China. The progressives are absolutely right. They have absolutely pegged the new right, why the new right cares about China. It's just so they can take their eternal search for an outgroup to punch down on and pick Asians in America. That's what it is.
You think Asians in America?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And immigrants. I mean, no, I like
immigrants. I haven't seen the Asians in America part.
Absolutely. I mean, like, look at Amy Wax. And so, by the way, it's not just, you know, it's not Chinese Americans at all. It, by just Chinese Americans by any stretch of the imagination. It's a lot of energy focused on Indian Americans who, you know, have no relation to China at all. But look at Amy Wax and some people from the Claremont Institute have been talking about how Asians are taking over our elite and it's bad and it's blah, blah. And these countries, Asian countries suck and how we don't want, you know, like just constantly complaining about, and they were complaining about, you know, like Chinese Americans before, and now they're complaining about Indian people, you know? And so that's definitely looking for an immigrant group to backlash against. So, you know, everyone talks about Trump, you know, putting kids in cages and saying Mexicans are rapists and all that stuff. But I think Trump realized pretty quickly that you don't want to alienate Hispanics. And you saw Trump actually gain a bit with Hispanics. And those gains are more moderate than sometimes portrayed, but they are real and they have persisted in the post-Trump era. We see Hispanics voting a little bit more Republican, maybe by like just, you know, 6 or 7% shift, but that's like, it's real. And it could continue. And so I think that, and there was the shooting, a guy in Texas in El Paso, just like shot up a bunch of like random Mexican people. That's pretty, but I think, and that was absolutely inspired by anti-immigrant rhetoric, but I think that the anti-immigrant stuff is focused more and more on Asian people for a number of reasons. Number one, because Hispanic immigration really trailed off. Like, there's a lot of Hispanic people who are here who are immigrants, but they didn't come here recently. The average like length of time that a Hispanic immigrant has been in America is going up and up because just far fewer are coming. And that's actually been true since 2007. There was a giant drop off around 2007 in immigration from Mexico specifically, and all the like caravans at the border and blah, 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 the Central American asylum seekers were like 1/10 of the amount that dropped off from Mexico. Like, Mexico was always the biggie. And Mexico really dropped off in terms of immigration. And so what that meant is that the lion's share of immigration that's coming in is from Asia. So if you're going to be anti-immigrant, you're going to have to be anti-Asian at this point.
Something I'd love to hear in our last like 10 minutes or so, I'd like to hear a quick articulation from you on your critique of the progressives more as a response to 2016. But then like, let's just finish up with, you wrote a recent post just sort of talking about like the next steps, like the next stages. Like, we focused this episode on like understanding, talking through the long 2010s. But what do you think the 2020s looks like?
Well, this is interesting. I get to make predictions. I think it's going to be a decade of exhaustion like the 70s culturally. We are going to
Can I interrupt you real quick? I've never seen a guest. I interview a lot of people. I do like 200 of these a year. You got very excited at the word prediction. People hate predictions. I normally am like, I'm not asking you to make a prediction. Maybe give me like, why did you get excited at making a prediction?
Because I already have some.
There we go. Okay, so you've done the work. Yeah. Okay, so that's the actual answer.
You're not thinking predictions I've already made.
Okay, there we go.
So that's... I love big, bold predictions.
Yeah.
Not necessarily because they're vague and easy to say I got right. I will say if I got them wrong. And I think I'm pretty, you know, harsh on my own predictions, but because I like it. That's the name of the pundit game. I want to make these big predictions. And if I get it wrong, I will take absolute responsibility for that. I've gotten a couple things wrong. I wrote a post about what I got wrong. And I could go on about what I got wrong. But I've got a lot of things right.
Yeah.
I got a lot of things right. Xi Jinping's fundamental incompetence. I got that right when everybody was saying Xi Jinping's like the master of everything. Like he's in control of everything. He's so good at what he does and blah, blah, blah. Under him, China shall rise. I was like, no, this is an old boomer dad who you know, it's just like, why can't we make real things anymore? Why do we have to have these internet companies? And like, that was who I saw him as. And I was right about that. He's just flailing. And like, he's very good at consolidating power around himself and sort of, you know, riding herd on the Chinese Communist Party as an organization. But he's bad at making actual consequential decisions. And, you know, he's very bad at this. He surrounds himself with cronies and he's not a smart guy to begin with. He's sort of like, I think of him as I sometimes describe him as a Trump type figure, but really he's more like a George W. Bush type figure. That's who he is. He is the Chinese George W. Bush. And
which is worse? Which is more of a like character definition? Is it worse to be the Chinese George W. Bush or the Chinese Trump?
Bush did more to advance American decline, right? Whereas Trump did more to advance social divisions.
Okay.
Trump tore our country apart. Bush kicked our country into the garbage can. How's that?
Yeah.
Bush weakened our country. Trump divided our country.
Okay,
and Xi Jinping is not dividing Chinese society so much as he's just weakening it with bad decisions. The Iraq war was a bad decision. Lack of financial regulation was a bad decision. Focusing on tax cuts as a way of boosting growth was a bad decision. And Xi is just making bad. In fact, I think Xi is in some ways worse than Bush. We'll see if he does his own Iraq war in Taiwan. We'll see if he makes that mistake. I wouldn't advise it, but I wouldn't advise any of this shit that he's done. So Xi Jinping, dumb. I got that right. And here's a big prediction. Unrest is going to subside in America. Popular unrest. This is the vibe shift. This is what I think people are feeling the start of, is that unrest has peaked. You saw in the midterms, Republicans did fine. Election deniers did not do fine.
Mm-hmm.
The Republicans' losses were mostly attributable to Trump-allied dipshit election deniers who just focused
not
on
reading the vibe. Carrie Lake did not read that people were out trying to elect a person who's going to get in weird fights with the media.
Blake Masters. Right. These people, even Lauren Boebert almost lost. And so the election deniers really took a pounding. It's because people are tired of this shit. Like, at this point, we realize there's no future in that. There's no, you know, people were willing, like some Republicans were willing to go along with it in 2020 when it seemed like, you know, Trump might be able to pull a repeat of Bush versus Gore and somehow stay in power with like legal machinations and Supreme Court decisions, stuff like that. But at this point, they see that it's just straight up arsonism, trashing of democracy. It's just lighting fire to democracy. It's just a dumpster fire. And people don't want it, but like a few people want it because there's still some people who are very extreme, who just read too much online and who are getting these fights too much. And these people, I think as unrest cools among the general populace, among the extremists who are still just always online and in these like extreme groups, we'll get more and more because the moderate people who are in those extremist groups will drop out. The more moderate people drop out and drop out. It's like with evaporation when like the hottest particles leave. So what remains gets colder. Here, the moderate people leave. So the crazy people get crazier. And so in the 70s, you saw crazy, actually the hardcore of the craziness be more severe than in the 60s. You had the Symbionese Liberation Army. You had two people try to shoot Gerald Ford within a month's period of time. In 1976, crazy, like, you know, you had massive shootouts between these leftist groups and police, you know, murders and jailbreaks and terrorism and all this stuff in the 70s but most people were just like, okay, I'll still wear bell bottoms and grow out my hair. But like, I realize there's not really going to be a revolution. That was like your average, you know, boomer in the 70s. And then by the 80s, they cut their hair and then they all went and got corporate jobs. And then you got the big chill, right? You've seen The Big Chill, right? About all these like formerly revolutionary boomers turning into like corporate yuppies.
Yes.
And like trying to reconcile themselves with their corporate yuppiehood. And it's a great movie and people hate it because it shows the ebbing of this revolutionary energy of a generation. We're going to get the same thing with the millennials, right? The millennials are aging into middle age now. Like, you know, I am a millennial. I am middle-aged. And an increasing majority of the millennials are middle-aged now. And so they're going to get maybe a little later than the boomers did, but they're going to get families and houses and jobs and pensions and stock market, blah, blah, blah. And like, you know, that will temper their fire for, like, you know, going in and fighting the cops.
Which political side is advantaged by this exhaustion you're describing? Or not even side, like, which figures or categories of figures are best set up for an exhausted America?
Well, of course, center-left normie libs. Yes, for the win. Liberal, suburban, wine mom. That's who's going to win. It's always the wine moms, the liberal, suburban wine mom is the emperor of this country politically. Whoever captures the suburban wine mom will win in America.
These were soccer moms under Bush.
Yes,
absolutely. After 9/11, 2002 right. midterms, Bush captures the security moms.
And yeah. Now after the pandemic and everyone's so stressed out and everyone's just like sitting alone drinking at home, they're wine moms. But they're the same people. They're just suburban moms. They're not, you know, like. I don't even know that they're mostly white anymore. I'd say probably maybe a minority of white people, but they're just it's a type. It's middle class. Mm-hmm. Middle class moms are like those are the most important factor. And so that middle class liberal normie white moms are gonna win. But then also the Ron DeSantis conservatives are going to come back because the unrest unleashed a lot of cultural weird ass shit. Such as the young people who go online and try to, like, you know, say a bunch of crazy, like, anti-sex stuff. And that's weird. But, like, there's a lot of weird stuff. If you go to DSA meetings, you'll encounter the weird stuff. And that's going to backlash the need for, like, every local school board and city council to, like, begin their, like, meetings with, like, a land acknowledgement and, like, a profession that this country was founded on racism. I mean, like, I get what you're saying, guys, but also that's silly. So,
time, like, place, manner.
Yeah, exactly. Time, place, manner. Like, unless you're, are you going to give your land back to Native Americans? No, then shut up. Because, like, we actually can do that. Canada has done it. We've done it in certain areas. The Supreme Court is mandating returning a lot of land to Native Americans in Oklahoma, which I think is great. You know, I'm a supporter of that. And I like that. But shut up with the, like, yes, we recognize we're on native land, but we're not going to do anything about it. Like, shut up. So there's going to be a general backlash against that. And I think that, and, you know, a lot of other stuff that's much crazier than that. That was just, like, a funny example. A lot of backlash against stuff that's crazier than that on the left. And I think that that's going to power the DeSantis conservatives. So I think that we're going to get a big question is what will be the foreign policy of the DeSantis conservatives? Will they stand up to, like, Russia and China in actuality, or will they embrace the isolationist, like, head in the sand approach of the Trumpists? That's an open question. I don't know, because there's still a lot of Republicans who want to kick Putin's ass.
I think right? The midterms probably, I think it was an open question. My suspicion is the midterms pushed them more in the stand up to China and Russia column.
I hope so. I hope that's right. Yeah, that's optimistic. And I hope so. And so I think that if they can recapture the things that actually worked about Reaganism, then they can rebuild a conservative movement. I think a lot of that's going to be stuff progressives really don't like. Progressives are going to absolutely howl and raise hell about, like, kicking trans women off women's sports teams. Stuff which is happening now in athletic organizations, and it's kind of quiet, but, like, that's happening, and that is going to, you know, progressives are going to say this denies the existence of trans people and will lead to, you know, massive death and blah blah, and conservatives are probably going to be able to win with that. I'm being dispassionate. I'm not saying what I would like, or I'm not saying I want to kick trans women off sports, and I'm saying I think that conservatives are going to make some headway with this. They're going to, you know, standing up to Putin, standing up to evil empires is a lot more fruitful than becoming an evil empire ourselves, right? Like, the Iraq war was a disaster, but standing up to the Soviet Union in the 80s was a big win, not just for us, but for the Republican Party as well. They're going to rediscover that. And that actually does work. In terms of economics, I don't know what they're going to do. I have things that I would suggest to them. But then I think that's too complicated and boring to go into right now. But I think eventually they'll the DeSantis conservatives will come up with an economic program that makes more sense than like some crazy, like, you know, I don't know, like white working class single breadwinner factory in rural Wisconsin nostalgia bellowing bullshit. They will come up with something better than that. And it'll take till the end of this decade. I think around late 2020s is when you're going to see the real conservative resurgence in this country.
So for the last question then, does that basically mean, I've just been conceiving of the 2020s as kind of like a reshuffling, almost kind of lost decade. This isn't the decade if you're looking for big things. Do you think the 2030s then look different? If people are exhausted, so are people just going to basically rest up for the next 6 or 7 years and then something happens in the 2030s? How do you think about that?
I think so. I just got a book about the 1970s, and the title of the book is "It Seemed Like Nothing Happened."
Okay.
Plenty did happen, but it seemed like nothing happened because America was so exhausted. After Watergate, 1973 was the end of the long 60s. And after that, we had this time until 1980, until the conservative resurgence, when it felt like there was nothing happening in American politics. We had Ford and Carter, these like gray old nobody presidents. We had, you know, social movements sort of left over from the 60s, slowly petering out. We had the slow, you know, underground rise of conservatism. We had all this stuff, and it seemed like the 60s got people primed for expectations of revolutions and social upheavals that didn't ultimately pan out. The 60s were the big change, but they got people thinking there would be an even bigger change in the 70s, and there just wasn't.
No, because
people got exhausted. We hit the end of our little energy bar in a video game. We're like,
so 2014 body cams, like with BLM,
yeah,
that's the big change, right? Not 2020 fever dreams that are just crazy in retrospect.
One thing people don't know, by the way, is that the 60s riots, which were a hell of a lot more like, you know, destructive and combative than the Floyd protests at their height, like just cities really did burn in the 60s.
Yeah.
Like city centers burned to the ground. Like there was massive, like there were just hundreds of deaths all over the place. National Guard brought in just shooting random people. That stuff was all over police violence. That stuff was all sparked by police violence. And that's not just unique to America. Riots and giant protests tend to be sparked by police violence everywhere. So body cams are big. Twitter is big. But it's a very, very old reason for unrest. It's a very, very, it's the spark. It's not, there's the tinder and the spark, right? There's the underlying reason, which I think was this like respect disconnect in American society in many, many ways. But then, and just, you know, police abuses, of course, had built up over the years. Police killings went like down and down through the 90s and then like went up massively in the 2000s. People don't even know that. The police militarized up in the 2000s with like surplus war and terror gear. And then they just, they got super, super Nazi in like the 2000s and 2010s. And like, you know, that was a big factor that led to BLM. You know, if police killings had kept declining like they did in the 90s, maybe we wouldn't have that. I don't know. So, so it's police, anti-police stuff is always the spark that lights the unrest at the beginning. But then in the explosion of unrest, all the stuff bubbles to the surface, all the stuff people are mad about, and then exhaustion, and then it goes, and then it settles, and now we're in the exhaustion period, and we will be exhausted, but in this decade, we'll be planted the seeds of highly transformative decades in the 2030s and 40s, I think. Those will be very transformative decades. Right now, people are building the technologies that will affect, you know, technology changes everything. Like the technology of the internet and social media and the smartphone and all that stuff was what enabled this age of unrest to happen. Mm-hmm. Right? That's where it all happened, on these technologies. But then those technologies were built off stuff that was conceived in the 70s. All the networking and, like, you know, satellite communications, all this stuff that like was all conceived in like the 70s and 80s, you know, as partly through defense stuff. I don't know. We are now going to build the technologies that will define those later decades. And we are now going to incubate new subcultures and social movements that will flower in those later decades. So we're doing sort of the groundwork, even as we're exhausted, we'll be slowly doing the groundwork, just as, you know, the 1970s, you could see the genesis of hip hop culture. You could see the genesis of like punk and like, you know, anarchists and crunchy hippies and all this stuff.
Evangelicals too.
Evangelicals, absolutely. The conservative revolution, you know, with really, you know, Billy Graham, all that stuff. Really, the 70s incubated the cultures that defined the next few decades. And I think now, while it looks like it will look like nothing's happening, but a lot of important stuff will be happening in a subterranean way.
Really well said. Noah, that's an excellent place to leave it. This is really great. Could you shout out your Substack, where people should go check out your work? Hopefully, you know, you'd send a few of the subscribers who weren't lost
already.
After the,
I know, right? Who listens to the end of podcasts? Noah Pinion, it's called. NOAH PINION. It's not Noah Opinion. There's no O in the middle. It's just NOAH PINION. Just Google that. You'll find the Substack. You can sign up. There's a free email list. More than half of what I write is free. Maybe two thirds is free. So, you know, yeah.
Good show. Thank you for joining me on The Realignment.
Thanks a lot, man.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for a lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.